This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Roadwork by Stephen King. Writing as Richard Bachman. Read by G. Valmont Thomas.
The Importance of Being Bachman by Stephen King. This is my second introduction to the so-called Bachman books, a phrase which has come to mean, in my mind at least, the first few novels published with the Richard Bachman name, the ones which appeared as unheralded paperback originals under the Signet imprint. My first introduction wasn't very good. To me, it reads like a textbook case of author obfuscation. But that is not surprising. When it was written, Bachman's alter ego, me, in other words, wasn't in what I'd call a contemplative or analytical mood. I was, in fact, feeling robbed. Bachman was never created as a short-term alias. He was supposed to be there for the long haul. And when my name came out in connection with his, I was surprised, upset, and pissed off. That's not a state conducive to good essay writing. This time I may do a little better. Probably the most important thing I can say about Richard Bachman is that he became real. Not entirely, of course, he said with a nervous smile. I am not writing this in a delusive state. Except, well, maybe I am. Delusion is, after all, something writers of fiction try to encourage in their readers, at least during the time that the book or story is open before them, and the writer is hardly immune from this state of, what shall I call it? How does directed delusion sound? At any rate, Richard Bachman began his career not as a delusion, but as a sheltered place where I could publish a few early works which I felt readers might like. Then he began to grow and come alive, as the creatures of a writer's imagination so frequently do. I began to imagine his life as a dairy farmer, his wife, the beautiful Claudia Inez Bachman, his solitary New Hampshire mornings spent milking the cows, getting in the wood, and thinking about his stories, his evenings spent writing, always with a glass of whiskey beside his Olivetti typewriter. I once knew a writer who would say his current story or novel was putting on weight if it was going well. In much the same way, my pen name began to put on weight. Then, when his cover was blown, Richard Bachman died. I made light of this in the few interviews I felt required to give on the subject, saying that he died of cancer of the pseudonym, but it was actually shock that killed him. The realization that sometimes people just won't let you alone. To put it in more fulsome, but not at all inaccurate terms, Bachman was the vampire side of my existence, killed by the sunlight of disclosure. My feelings about all this were confused enough, and fertile enough, to bring on a book, a Stephen King book, that is, The Dark Half. It was about a writer whose pseudonym, George Stark, actually comes to life. It's a novel my wife has always detested. Perhaps because, for Thad Beaumont, the dream of being a writer overwhelms the reality of being a man. For Thad, delusive thinking overtakes rationality completely, with horrific consequences. I didn't have that problem, though. Really. I put Bachman aside, and although I was sorry that he had to die, I would be lying if I didn't say I felt some relief as well. The books in this omnibus were written by a young man who was angry, energetic, and deeply infatuated with the art and craft of writing. They weren't written as Bachman books, per se. Bachman hadn't been invented yet, after all. But in a Bachman state of mind. Low rage, sexual frustration, crazy good humor, and simmering despair. Ben Richards, the scrawny, pre-tubercular protagonist of The Running Man, he is about as far from the Arnold Schwarzenegger character in the movie as you can get, crashes his hijacked plane into the Network Games skyscraper, killing himself but taking hundreds, maybe thousands, of Freevee executives with him. This is the Richard Bachman version of a happy ending. The conclusions of the other Bachman novels are even more grim. Stephen King has always understood that the good guys don't always win. See Cujo, Pet Sematary, and perhaps Christine. But he has also understood that mostly they do. Every day, in real life, the good guys win. Mostly these victories go unheralded. man arrives home safe from work yet again, wouldn't sell many papers. But they are nonetheless real for all that, and fiction should reflect reality. And yet? In the first draft of The Dark Half, I had Thad Beaumont quote Donald E. Westlake, a very funny writer who has penned a series of very grim crime novels under the name Richard Stark. Once asked to explain the dichotomy between Westlake and Stark, the writer in question said, "I write Westlake stories on sunny days. When it rains, I'm Stark." I don't think that made it into the final version of The Dark Half, but I've always loved it, and related to it, as it has become fashionable to say. Bachman, a fictional creation who became more real to me with each published book which bore his byline, was a rainy day sort of guy if ever there was one. The good folks mostly win. Courage usually triumphs over fear. The family dog hardly ever contracts rabies. These are things I knew at 25, and things I still know now at the age of 25 times two. But I know something else as well. There's a place in most of us where the rain is pretty much constant. The shadows are always long, and the woods are full of monsters. It is good to have a voice in which the terrors of such a place can be articulated, and its geography partially described, without denying the sunshine and clarity that fill so much of our ordinary lives. In Thinner, Bachman spoke for the first time on his own. It was the only one of the early Bachman novels that had his name on the first draft instead of mine, and it struck me as really unfair that, just as he was starting to talk with his own voice, he should have been mistaken for me. And a mistake was just what it felt like, because by then Bachman had become a kind of id for me. He said the things I couldn't. And the thought of him out there on his New Hampshire dairy farm, not a best-selling writer who gets his name in some stupid Forbes list of entertainers too rich for their own good, or his face on the Today Show or doing cameos in movies, quietly writing his books gave him permission to think in ways I could not think, and speak in ways I could not speak. And then these new stories came out saying Bachman is really king, and there was no one, not even me, to defend the dead man, or to point out the obvious, that King was also really Bachman, at least some of the time. Unfair, I thought then, and unfair, I think now, but sometimes life bites you a little, that's all. I determined to put Bachman out of my thoughts and my life, and so I did, for a number of years. Then, while I was writing a novel, a Stephen King novel, called Desperation, Richard Bachman suddenly appeared in my life again. I was working on a Wang-dedicated word processor at that time. It looked like a Visiphone in an old Flash Gordon serial. This was paired with a marginally more state-of-the-art laser printer, and from time to time, when an idea occurred to me, I would write down a phrase or a putative title on a scrap of paper and scotch tape it to the side of the printer. As I neared the three-quarter mark on Desperation, I had a scrap with a single word printed on it. Regulators. I had had a great idea for a novel, something that had to do with toys, guns, TV, and suburbia. I didn't know if I would ever write it. Lots of those printer notes never came to anything, but it was certainly cool to think about. Then, one rainy day, a Richard Stark sort of day, as I was pulling into my driveway, I had an idea. I don't know where it came from. It was totally unconnected to any of the trivia tumbling through my head at the time. The idea was to take the characters from Desperation and put them into the Regulators. In some cases, I thought, they could play the same people. In others, they would change. In neither case would they do the same things or react in the same ways, because the different stories would dictate different courses of action. It would be, I thought, like the members of a repertory company acting in two different plays. Then, an even more exciting idea struck me. If I could use the rep company concept with the characters, I could use it with the plot itself as well. I could stack a good many of the Desperation elements in a brand new configuration and create a kind of mirror world. I knew, even before setting out, that plenty of critics would call this twinning a stunt, and they would not be wrong, exactly. But, I thought, it could be a good stunt. Maybe even an illuminating stunt, one which showcased the muscularity and versatility of story, its all but limitless ability to adapt a few basic elements into endlessly pleasing variations, its prankish charm. But the two books couldn't sound exactly the same, and they couldn't mean the same, any more than an Edward Albee play and one by William Inge can sound and mean the same, even if they are performed on successive nights by the same company of actors. How could I possibly create a different voice? At first I thought I couldn't, and that it would be best to consign the idea to the Rube Goldberg bin I keep in the bottom of my mind, the one marked interesting but unworkable contraptions. Then it occurred to me that I had had the answer all along. Richard Bachman could write The Regulators. His voice sounded superficially the same as mine, but underneath there was a world of difference. All the difference between sunshine and rain, let us say. And his view of people was always different from mine, simultaneously funnier and more cold-hearted. Bart Dawes in Roadwork, my favorite of the early Bachman books, is an excellent example. Of course, Bachman was dead. I denounced that myself. But death is actually a minor problem for a novelist. Just ask Paul Sheldon, who brought Misery Chastain back for Annie Wilkes. Or Arthur Conan Doyle, who brought Sherlock Holmes back from Reichenbach Falls when fans all over the British Empire clamored for him. I didn't actually bring Richard Bachman back from the dead anyway. I just visualized the box of neglected manuscripts in his basement, with The Regulators on top. Then I transcribed the book Bachman had already written. That transcription was a little tougher, but it was also immensely exhilarating. It was wonderful to hear Bachman's voice again, and what I had hoped might happen did happen. A book rolled out that was a kind of fraternal twin to the one I had written under my own name, and the two books were quite literally written back to back. The King book finished on one day, and the Bachman book commenced on the very next. They were no more alike than King and Bachman themselves. Desperation is about God. The Regulators is about TV. I guess that makes them both about higher powers, but very different ones just the same. The importance of being Bachman was always the importance of finding a good voice and a valid point of view that were a little different from my own. Not really different. I am not schizo enough to believe that, but I do believe that there are tricks all of us use to change our perspectives and our perceptions, to see ourselves new by dressing up in different clothes and doing our hair in different styles, and that such tricks can be very useful, a way of revitalizing and refreshing old strategies for living life, observing life, and creating art. None of these comments are intended to suggest that I have done anything great in the Bachman books, and they are surely not made as arguments for artistic merit, but I love what I do too much to want to go stale if I can help it. Bachman has been one way in which I have tried to refresh my craft and to keep from being too comfy and well padded. These early books show some progression of the Bachman persona, I hope, and I hope they also show the essence of that persona. Dark-toned, despairing even when he's laughing, despairing most when he's laughing, in fact. Richard Bachman isn't a fellow I'd want to be all the time, even if he were still alive. But it's good to have that option, that window in the world, polarized though it may be. Still, as the reader works his or her way through these stories, he or she may discover that Dick Bachman has one thing in common with Thad Beaumont's alter ego George Stark. He's not a very nice guy. And I wonder if there are any other good manuscripts at or near completion in that box found by the widowed Mrs. Bachman in the cellar of her New Hampshire farmhouse. Sometimes I wonder about that a lot. Stephen King. Lovell, Maine, April 16, 1996. In memory of Charlotte Littlefield. Proverbs 31:10-28. Prologue. I don't know why. You don't know why. Most likely God don't know why either. It's just government business. That's all. Man in the Street interview concerning Vietnam circa 1967. But Vietnam was over, and the country was getting on. On this hot August afternoon in 1972, The WHLM newsmobile was parked near Westgate at the end of the Route 784 expressway. There was a small crowd around a bunting-covered podium that had been hurriedly tossed together. The bunting was thin flesh on a skeleton of naked planks. Behind it, at the top of a grassy embankment, were the highway toll booths. In front of it, open, marshy land stretched toward the suburban hem of the city's outskirts. A young reporter named Dave Albert was doing a series of man-on-the-street interviews while he and his co-workers waited for the mayor and the governor to arrive for the groundbreaking ceremony. He held the microphone toward an elderly man wearing tinted spectacles.
"Well," the elderly man said, looking tremulously into the camera, "I think it's a great thing for the city. We've needed this a long time. It's a great thing for the city."
He swallowed, aware that his mind was broadcasting echoes of itself, helpless to stop, hypnotized by the grinding, cyclopean eye of posterity.
"Great,"
he added limply. "Thank you, sir. Thank you very much."
"Do you think they'll use it on the news tonight?"
Albert flashed a professional, meaningless smile. "Hard to tell, sir. There's a good chance." His sound man pointed up to the toll gate turnaround, where the governor's Chrysler Imperial had just pulled up, winking and gleaming like a chrome-inlaid eight-ball in the summer sunshine. Albert nodded back, held up a single finger. He and the cameraman approached a guy in a white shirt with rolled-up sleeves. The guy was looking moodily at the podium. "Would you mind stating your opinion of all this, Mr.?"
"Dawes."
"No, I don't mind." His voice was low. Pleasant.
"Speed,"
the cameraman murmured. The man in the white shirt said, still pleasantly,
"I think it's a piece of shit."
The cameraman grimaced. Albert nodded, looking at the man in the white shirt reproachfully, and then made cutting gestures with the first two fingers of his right hand. The elderly gentleman was looking at this tableau with real horror. Above, up by the toll booths, the governor was getting out of his imperial. His green tie was resplendent in the sun. The man in the white shirt said politely,
"Will that be on the 6 or 11 o'clock news?"
"Ho, ho, fella, you're a riot," Albert said sourly, and walked away to catch the governor. The cameraman trailed after him. The man in the white shirt watched the governor as he came carefully down the grassy slope. Albert met the man in the white shirt again 17 months later. But since neither of them remember that they had met before, it might as well have been the first time. Part 1. November. November 20, 1973. He kept doing things without letting himself think about them. Safer that way. It was like having a circuit breaker in his head, and it thumped into place every time part of him tried to ask, "But why are you doing this?" Part of his mind would go dark. "Hey, Georgie, who turned out the lights?" "Whoops, I did." "Something screwy in the wiring, I guess. Just a sec." Reset the switch, the lights go back on. But the thought is gone. Everything is fine. Let us continue, Freddy. Where were we? He was walking to the bus stop when he saw the sign that said, "Ammo, Harvey's Gun Shop Ammo. Remington, Winchester, Colt, Smith, and Wesson. Hunters, welcome." It was snowing a little out of a gray sky. It was the first snow of the year, and it landed on the pavement like white splotches of baking soda, then melted. He saw a little boy in a red-knitted cap go by with his mouth open and his tongue out to catch a flake. "It's just going to melt, Freddy," he thought of the kid. But the kid went on anyway, with his head cocked back at the sky. He stopped in front of Harvey's gun shop, hesitating. There was a rack of late-edition newspapers outside the door, and the headline said, "Shaky ceasefire holds." Below that, on the rack, was a smudged white sign that said, "Please pay for your paper. This is an honor rack. Dealer must pay for all papers." It was warm inside. The shop was long, but not very wide. There was only a single aisle. Inside the door, on the left, was a glass case filled with boxes of ammunition. He recognized the .22 cartridges immediately, because he'd had a .22 single-shot rifle as a boy in Connecticut. He had wanted that rifle for 3 years, and when he finally got it, he couldn't think of anything to do with it. He shot at cans for a while, then shot a blue jay. The jay hadn't been a clean kill. It sat in the snow surrounded by a pink bloodstain, its beak slowly opening and closing. After that, he had put the rifle up on hooks, and it had stayed there for 3 years until he sold it to a kid up the street for $9 and a carton of funny books. The other ammunition was less familiar. 30-30, 30-06, and some that looked like scale model howitzer shells. What animals do you kill with those, he wondered. Tigers? Dinosaurs? Still, it fascinated him, sitting there inside the glass case like penny candy in a stationery store. The clerk or proprietor was talking to a fat man in green pants and a green fatigue shirt. The shirt had flap pockets. They were talking about a pistol that was lying on top of another glass case, dismembered. The fat man thumbed back the slide, and they both peered into the oiled chamber. The fat man said something, and the clerk or proprietor laughed.
"Autos always jam. You got that from your father, Mac. Admit it."
"Harry, you're full of bullshit up to your eyebrows."
"You're full of it, Fred," he thought. "Right up to your eyebrows. You know it, Fred?" Fred said he knew it. On the right was a glass case that ran the length of the shop. It was full of rifles on pegs. He was able to pick out the double-barreled shotguns, but everything else was a mystery to him. Yet some people, the two at the far counter, for example, had mastered this world as easily as he had mastered general accounting in college. He walked further into the store and looked into a case filled with pistols. He saw some air guns, a few .22s, a .38 with a wood grip handle, .45s, and a gun he recognized as a .44 Magnum, the gun Dirty Harry had carried in that movie. He had heard Ron Stone and Vinnie Mason talking about that movie at the laundry, and Vinnie had said they'd never let a cop carry a gun like that in the city. You can blow a hole in a man a mile away with one of those. The fat man, Mac, and the clerk or proprietor, Harry, as in Dirty Harry, had the gun back together.
"You give me a call when you get that Menschler in," Mac said.
"I will, but your prejudice against autos is irrational," Harry said.
He decided Harry must be the proprietor. A clerk would never call a customer irrational.
"Have you got to have the Cobra next week?"
"I'd like it,"
Mac said.
"I don't promise."
"You never do, but you're the best goddamn gunsmith in the city, and you know it."
"Of course I do."
Mac patted the gun on top of the glass case and turned to go. Mac bumped into him. "Watch it, Mac. Smile when you do that." And then went on to the door. The paper was tucked under Mac's arm, and he could read, "Shaky CEA." Harry turned to him, still smiling and shaking his head.
"Can I help you?"
"I hope so, but I warn you in advance. I know nothing about guns." Harry shrugged.
"There's a law you should? Is it for someone else? For Christmas?"
"Yes, that's just right," he said, seizing on it. "I've got this cousin, Nick. His name is Nick Adams. He lives in Michigan, and he's got yay guns, you know, loves to hunt. But it's more than that. It's sort of a hobby?" Harry asked, smiling.
"Yes, that's it."
He had been about to say fetish. His eyes dropped to the cash register, where an aged bumper sticker was pasted on. The bumper sticker said, "If guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns." He smiled at Harry and said, "That's very true, you know."
"Sure it is," Harry said. "This cousin of yours?"
"Well, it's kind of a one-upmanship type of thing. He knows how much I like boating, and I'll be damned if he didn't up and give me an Evinrude 60-horsepower motor last Christmas. He sent it by REA Express. I gave him a hunting jacket. I felt sort of like a horse's ass." Harry nodded sympathetically.
"Well, I got a letter from him about 6 weeks ago, and he sounds just like a kid with a free pass to the circus. It seems that he and about six buddies chipped in together and bought themselves a trip to this place in Mexico, sort of like a free fire zone."
"A no-limit hunting preserve?"
"Yeah, that's it," he chuckled a little. You shoot as much as you want. They stock it, you know. Deer, antelope, bear, Bison. Everything.
Was it Boca Rio?
I really don't remember. I think the name was longer than that.
Harry's eyes had gone slightly dreamy.
That guy that just left and myself and two others went to Boca Rio in 1965. I shot a zebra.
A goddamn zebra. I got it mounted in my game room at home. That was the best time I ever had in my life, bar none. I envy your cousin.
Well, I talked it over with my wife, he said. And she said, go ahead. We had a very good year at the laundry. I work at the Blue Ribbon Laundry over in Western.
Yes, I know where that is.
He felt that he could go on talking to Harry all day, for the rest of the year, embroidering the truth and the lies into a beautiful, gleaming tapestry. Let the world go by. Fuck the gas shortage and the high price of beef and the shaky ceasefire. Let there be talk of cousins that never were. Right, Fred?
Right on, Georgie.
We got the Central Hospital account this year, as well as the mental institution, and also three new motels.
Is the Quality Motor Court on Franklin Avenue one of yours?
Yes, it is.
I've stayed there a couple of times, Harry said.
The sheets were always very clean.
Funny, you never think about who washes the sheets when you stay at a motel.
Well, we had a good year. And so I thought maybe I can get Nick a rifle and a pistol. I know he's always wanted a .44 Magnum. I've heard him mention that one.
Harry brought the Magnum up and laid it carefully on top of the glass case. He picked it up. He liked the heft of it. It felt like business. He put it back down on the glass case.
The chambering on that, Harry began.
He laughed and held up a hand.
Don't sell me. I'm sold. An ignoramus always sells himself. How much ammunition should I get with that?
Harry shrugged.
Get him 10 boxes, why don't you? He can always get more. The price on that gun is $289 plus tax, but I'm going to give it to you for $280. Ammo thrown in, how's that?
Super, he said, meaning it. And then, because something more seemed required, he added, it's a handsome piece.
If it's Boca Rio, he'll put it to good use.
Now, the rifle.
What does he have?
He shrugged and spread his hands.
I'm sorry. I really don't know. 2 or 3 shotguns and something he calls an autoloader.
Remington?
Harry asked him so quickly that he felt afraid.
It was as if he had been walking in waist-deep water that had suddenly shelled off.
I think it was. I could be wrong.
Remington makes the best, Harry said, and nodded, putting him at ease again.
How high do you want to go?
Well, I'll be honest with you. The motor probably costs them 400. I'd like to go at least 5. 600 tops.
You and this cousin really get along, don't you?
We grew up together, he said sincerely. I think I'd give my right arm to Nick if he wanted it.
Well, let me show you something, Harry said. He picked a key out of a bundle on his ring and went to one of the glass cabinets.
He opened it, climbed up on a stool, and brought down a long, heavy rifle with an inlaid stock.
This may be a little higher than you want to go, but it's a beautiful gun.
Harry handed it to him.
What is it?
That's a .460 Weatherby. Shoots heavier ammunition than I've got here in the place right now. I'd have to order however many rounds you wanted from Chicago. Take about a week. It's a perfectly weighted gun. The muzzle energy on that baby is over 8,000 pounds, like hitting something with an airport limousine. If you hit a buck in the head with it, you'd have to take the tail for a trophy.
I don't know, he said, sounding dubious even though he had decided he wanted the rifle.
I know Nick wants trophies. That's part of...
Sure it is, Harry said, taking the Weatherby and chambering it.
The hole looked big enough to put a carrier pigeon in.
Nobody goes to Boca Rio for meat. So your cousin gut shoots. With this piece, you don't have to worry about tracking the goddamn animal for 12 miles through the high country. The animal's suffering the whole time, not to mention you missing dinner. This baby will spread his insides over 20 feet.
How much?
Well, I'll tell you. I can't move it in town. Who wants a freaking anti-tank gun when there's nothing to go after anymore but pheasant? And if you put them on the table,
Tastes like you're eating exhaust fumes. It retails for $9.50, wholesales for $6.30. I'd let you have it for $700.
That comes to, almost $1,000.
We give a 10% discount on orders over $300. That brings it back to $9.
He shrugged.
You give that gun to your cousin? I guarantee he hasn't got one. If he does, I'll buy it back for $750. I'll put that in writing. That's how sure I am.
No kidding.
Absolutely, absolutely. Of course, if it's too steep, it's too steep. We could look at some other guns, but if he is a real nut on the subject, I don't have anything else he might not have two of.
I see. He put a thoughtful expression on his face.
Have you got a telephone?
Sure, in the back. Want to call your wife and talk it over?
I think I better.
Sure. Come on.
Harry led him into a cluttered back room. There was a bench and a scarred wooden table littered with gun guts, springs, cleaning fluid, pamphlets, and labeled bottles with lead slugs in them.
There's the phone, Harry said.
He sat down, picked up the phone, and dialed while Harry went back to get the Magnum and put it in the box.
Thank you for calling the WDST weather phone, the bright recorded voice said. This afternoon, snow flurries developing into light snow late this evening.
Hi, Mary, he said. Listen, I'm in this place called Harvey's Gun Shop. Yeah, about Nikki. I got the pistol we talked about, no problem. There was one right in the showcase. Then the guy showed me this rifle.
Clearing by tomorrow afternoon. Lows tonight will be in the 30s, tomorrow in the mid to upper 40s. Chance of precipitation tonight.
So what do you think I should do?
Harry was standing in the doorway behind him. He could see the shadow.
Yeah, he said. I know that.
Thank you for dialing the WDST weather phone, and be sure to watch News Plus 60 with Bob Reynolds each weekday evening at 6 o'clock for a weather update. Goodbye.
You're not kidding. I know it's a lot.
Thank you for calling the WDST weather phone. This afternoon, snow flurries developing into...
You sure, honey?
Chance of precipitation tonight, 80%. Tomorrow...
Well, okay.
He turned on the bench, grinned at Harry, and made a circle with his right thumb and forefinger.
He's a nice guy. Said he'd guarantee me Nick didn't have one.
By tomorrow afternoon. Lowe's tonight.
I love you too, Mayor. Bye.
He hung up. Jesus, Freddy, that was neat.
It was, George. It was.
He got up.
She says go if I say okay.
I do.
Harry smiled. What are you going to do if he sends you a Thunderbird?
He smiled back.
Return it unopened.
As they walked back out, Harry asked,
Check or charge?
American Express, if it's okay.
Good as gold. He got his card out. On the back, written on the special strip, it said, Barton George Dawes.
You sure the shells will come in time for me to ship everything to Fred?
Harry looked up from the credit blank.
Fred?
His smile expanded.
Nick is Fred, and Fred is Nick, he said. Nicholas Frederick Adams. It's kind of a joke about the name, from when we were kids.
Oh.
He smiled politely, as people do when the joke is in and they are out.
You want to sign here?
He signed. Harry took another book out from under the counter, a heavy one with a steel chain punched through the upper left corner near the binding.
And your name and address here for the Federals.
He felt his fingers tighten on the pen.
Sure, he said. Look at me. I never bought a gun in my life, and I'm mad.
He wrote his name and address in the book. Barton George Dawes, 1241 Crestallen Street West.
They're into everything, he said.
This is nothing to what they'd like to do, Harry said.
I know. You know what I heard on the news the other day? They want a law that says a guy riding on a motorcycle has to wear a mouth protector.
A mouth protector, for God's sake. Now, is it the government's business if a man wants to chance wrecking his bridge work?
Not in my book it isn't, Harry said, putting his book under the counter.
Or look at that highway extension they're building over in Western. Some snot-nosed surveyor says it's going through here, and the state sends out a bunch of letters, and the letters say, sorry, we're putting the 784 extension through here. You've got a year to find a new house. It's a goddamn shame.
Yes, it is. What does eminent domain mean to someone who's lived in the friggin' house for 20 years, made love to their wife there, and brought their kid up there, and come home to there from trips? That's just something from a law book that they made up so they can crook you better.
Watch it. Watch it. But the circuit breaker was a little slow and some of it got through.
You okay?
Harry asked.
Yeah.
I had one of those submarine sandwiches for lunch. I should know better. They gave me gas like hell.
Try one of these,
Harry said, and took a roll of pills from his breast pocket. Written on the outside was Rolaids.
Thanks, he said.
He took one off the top and popped it into his mouth, never minding the bit of lint on it. Look at me, I'm in a TV commercial. Consumes 47 times its own weight in excess stomach acid.
They always do the trick for me, Harry said.
About the shells.
Sure, a week, no more than two. I'll get you 70 rounds.
Well, why don't you keep these guns right here? Tag them with my name or something. I guess I'm silly, but I really don't want them in the house.
That's silly, isn't it?
To each his own, Harry said, equably.
Okay, let me write down my office number. When those bullets come in...
Cartridges, Harry interrupted.
Cartridges, or shells.
Cartridges, he said, smiling.
When they come in, give me a ring. I'll pick the guns up and make arrangements about shipping them.
REA will ship guns, won't they?
Sure. Your cousin will have to sign for them on the other end, that's all.
He wrote his name on one of Harry's business cards. The card said, Harold Swinnerton, 849-6330, Harvey's Gun Shop, Ammunition, Antique Guns.
Say, he said, if you're Harold, who's Harvey?
Harvey was my brother. He died 8 years ago.
I'm sorry.
We all were. He came down here one day, opened up, cleared the cash register, and then dropped dead of a heart attack. One of the sweetest men you'd ever want to meet. He could bring down a deer at 200 yards.
He reached over the counter and they shook.
I'll call,
Harry promised.
Take good care.
He went out into the snow again, past shaky ceasefire holds. It was coming down a little harder now, and his gloves were home.
What were you doing in there, George? Thump. The circuit breaker.
By the time he got to the bus stop, it might have been an incident he had read about somewhere. No more. Crestallen Street West was a long, downward-curving street that had enjoyed a fair view of the park and an excellent view of the river until progress had intervened in the shape of a high-rise housing development. It had gone up on Westfield Avenue 2 years before and had blocked most of the view. Number 1241 was a split-level ranch house with a one-car garage beside it. There was a long front yard, now barren and waiting for snow, real snow, to cover it. The driveway was asphalt, freshly hot-topped the previous spring. He went inside and heard the TV, the new Zenith cabinet model they had gotten in the summer. There was a motorized antenna on the roof, which he had put up himself. She had not wanted that, because of what was supposed to happen, but he had insisted. If it could be mounted, he had reasoned, it could be dismounted when they moved. Bart, don't be silly. It's just extra expense, just extra work for you. But he had outlasted her, and finally she said she would humor him. That's what she said on the rare occasions, when he cared enough about something to force it through the sticky molasses of her arguments. All right, Bart, this time I'll humor you. At the moment, she was watching Merv Griffin chat with a celebrity. The celebrity was Lorne Greene, who was talking about his new police series, Griff. Lorne was telling Merv how much he loved doing the show. Soon, a black singer, a Negress songstress, he thought, who no one had ever heard of would come on and sing a song. I left my heart in San Francisco, perhaps.
Hi, Mary, he called.
Hi, Bart.
Mail on the table. He flipped through it. A letter to Mary from her slightly psycho sister in Baltimore. A Gulf credit card bill, $38. A checking account statement, 49 debits, 9 credits, $954.47 balance. A good thing he had used American Express at the gun shop.
The coffee's hot, Mary called. Or did you want a drink?
Drink, he said. I'll get it.
3 other pieces of mail. An overdue notice from the library. Facing the Lions by Tom Wicker. Wicker had spoken to a Rotary luncheon a month ago, and he was the best speaker they'd had in years. A personal note from Stefan Ordner, one of the managerial bigwigs in Amroco, the corporation that now owned the Blue Ribbon almost outright. Ordner wanted him to drop by and discuss the Waterford deal. Would Friday be okay, or was he planning to be away for Thanksgiving? If so, give a call. If not, bring Mary. Carla always enjoyed the chance to see Mary, and blah, blah, and bullshit, bullshit, etc., et al. And another letter from the highway department. He stood looking down at it for a long time in the gray afternoon light that fell through the windows, and then put all the mail on the sideboard. He made himself a Scotch Rocks and took it into the living room. Merv was still chatting with Lorne. The color on the new Zenith was more than good. It was nearly occult. He thought, if our ICBMs are as good as our color TV, there's going to be a hell of a big bang someday. Lauren's hair was silver, the most impossible shade of silver conceivable. Boy, I'll snatch you bald-headed, he thought, and chuckled. It had been one of his mother's favorite sayings. He could not say why the image of Lorne Green bald-headed was so amusing. A light attack of belated hysteria over the gun shop episode, maybe. Mary looked up, a smile on her lips.
A funny?
Nothing, he said. Just my thinks.
He sat down beside her and pecked her cheek. She was a tall woman, 38 now, and at that crisis of looks where early prettiness is deciding what to be in middle age, her skin was very good, her breasts small and not apt to sag much. She ate a lot, but her conveyor belt metabolism kept her slim. She would not be apt to tremble at the thought of wearing a bathing suit on a public beach 10 years from now, no matter how the gods decided to dispose of the rest of her case. It made him conscious of his own slight bay window. Hell, Freddy, every executive has a bay window. It's a success symbol, like a Delta 88. That's right, George. Watch the old ticker and the cancer sticks, and you'll see 80 yet.
How did it go today? She asked.
Good.
Did you get out to the new plant in Waterford?
Not today.
He hadn't been out to Waterford since late October. Ordner knew it. A little bird must have told him. And hence the note. The site of the new plant was a vacated textile mill. And the smart Mick realtor handling the deal kept calling him. We have to close this thing out, the smart Mick realtor kept telling him. You people aren't the only ones over in Westside with your fingers in the crack. I'm going as fast as I can, he told the smart Mick realtor. You'll have to be patient.
What about the place in Crescent? She asked him. The brick house.
It's out of our reach, he said. They're asking $48,000.
For that place? She asked indignantly. Highway robbery.
It sure is.
He took a deep swallow of his drink.
What did old B from Baltimore have to say?
The usual. She's into consciousness-raising group hydrotherapy now. Isn't that a sketch? Bart?
It sure is, he said quickly.
Bart, we've got to get moving on this. January 20th is coming, and we'll be out in the street.
I'm going as fast as I can, he said. We just have to be patient.
That little colonial on Union Street
is sold,
he finished, and drained his drink.
Well, that's what I mean, she said, exasperated. That would have been perfectly fine for the two of us. With the money the city's allowing us for this house and lot, we could have been ahead.
I didn't like it.
You don't seem to like very much these days, she said with surprising bitterness. He didn't like it, she told the TV. The Negress songstress was on now, singing Alfie.
Mary, I'm doing all I can.
She turned and looked at him, earnestly.
Bart, I know how you feel about this house.
No, you don't, he said. Not at all. November 21, 1973. A light skim of snow had fallen over the world during the night, and when the bus doors chuffed open and he stepped onto the sidewalk, he could see the tracks of the people who had been there before him. He walked down First Street from the corner, hearing the bus pull away behind him with its tiger purr. Then Johnny Walker passed him, headed out for his second pickup of the morning. Johnny waved from the cab of his blue and white laundry van, and he waved back. It was a little after 8 o'clock. The laundry began its day at 7, when Ron Stone, the foreman, and Dave Radner, who ran the washroom, got there and ran up the pressure on the boiler. The shirt girls punched in at 7:30, and the girls who ran the speed ironer came in at 8. He hated the downstairs of the laundry where the brute work went on, where the exploitation went on. But for some perverse reason, the men and women who worked there liked him. They called him by his first name, and with a few exceptions, he liked them. He went in through the driver's loading entrance and threaded through the baskets of sheets from last night that the ironer hadn't run yet. Each basket was covered tightly with plastic to keep the dust off. Down front, Ron Stone was tightening the drive belt on the old Milner single pocket, while Dave and his helper, a college dropout named Steve Pollock, were loading the industrial Wash-X machines with motel sheets.
"Bart!"
Ron Stone greeted him. He bellowed everything. 30 years of talking to people over the combined noises of dryers, ironers, shirt presses, and washers on extract had built the bellow into his system.
"This son of a bitch Milner keeps seizing up. The program's so far over to bleach now that Dave has to run it on manual, and the extract keeps cutting out."
"We've got the Kilgallen order," he soothed. "2 more months."
"In the Waterford plant?"
"Sure," he said, a little giddy.
2 more months and I'll be ready for the nuthatch," Stone said darkly. "And switching over, it's gonna be worse than a Polish army parade."
"The orders will back up, I guess."
"Back up? We won't get dug out for 3 months! Then it'll be summer!"
He nodded, not wanting to go on with it.
"What are you running first?"
"Holiday Inn."
"Get 100 pounds of towels in with every load. You know how they scream for towels."
"Yeah, they scream for everything."
"How much you got?"
"They marked in 600 pounds, mostly from the Shriners. Most of them stayed over Monday. Cummiest sheets I ever seen. Some of them would stand on end."
He nodded toward the new kid, Pollock. "How's he working out?" The Blue Ribbon had a fast turnover in washroom helpers. Dave worked them hard, and Ron's bellowing made them nervous, then resentful.
"Okay so far," Stone said. "Do you remember the last one?"
He remembered. The kid had lasted 3 hours.
"Yeah, I remember. What was his name?"
Ron Stone's brow grew thundery.
"I don't remember. Baker or Barker or something like that. I saw him at the Stop and Shop last Friday, handing out leaflets about a lettuce boycott or something. That's something, isn't it? A fellow can't hold a job, so he goes out telling everyone how fucking lousy it is that America can't be like Russia. That breaks my heart."
"You'll run Howard Johnson next?"
Stone looked wounded.
"We always run it first thing."
"By 9?
"Bet your ass."
Dave waved to him, and he waved back. He went upstairs, through dry cleaning, through accounting, and into his office. He sat down behind his desk in his swivel chair and pulled everything out of the inbox to read. On his desk was a plaque that said, "Think. It may be a new experience." He didn't care much for that sign, but he kept it on his desk because Mary had given it to him. When? 5 years back? He sighed. The salesmen that came through thought it was funny. They laughed like hell.
But then if you showed a salesman a picture of starving kids or Hitler copulating with the Virgin Mary, he would laugh like hell.
Vinnie Mason, the little bird who had undoubtedly been chirruping in Steve Ordner's ear, had a sign on his desk that said, "Think."
T-H-I-M-K, Now, what kind of sense did that make?
Think.
Not even a salesman would laugh at that. Right, Fred?
Right, George. Correct.
There were heavy diesel rumblings outside, and he swiveled his chair around to look. The highway people were getting ready to start another day. A long flatbed with two bulldozers on top of it was going by the laundry, followed by an impatient line of cars. From the third floor, over dry cleaning, you could watch the progress of the construction. It cut across the western business and residential sections like a long brown incision, an operation scar poulticed with mud. It was already across Gilder Street, and it had buried the park on Hebner Avenue where he used to take Charlie when he was small. No more than a baby, really. What was the name of the park? He didn't know. Just the Hebner Avenue Park, I guess, Fred. There was a little league ballpark and a bunch of teeter-totters and a duck pond with a little house in the middle of it. In the summertime, the roof of the little house was always covered with bird shit. There had been swings, too. Charlie got his first swing experience in the Hebner Avenue Park. What do you think of that, Freddy old kid old sock? Scared him at first, and he cried, and then he liked it. And when it was time to go home, he cried because I took him off. Wet his pants all over the car seat coming home. Was that really 14 years ago? Another truck went by, carrying a payloader. The Garson block had been demolished about 4 months ago. That was 3 or 4 blocks west of Hebner Avenue. A couple of office buildings full of loan companies and a bank or two. The rest, dentists and chiropractors and foot doctors. That didn't matter so much, but Christ, it had hurt to see the old Grand Theater go. He had seen some of his favorite movies there in the early 50s. Dial M for Murder with Ray Milland. The Day the Earth Stood Still with Michael Rennie. That one had been on TV just the other night, and he had meant to watch it, and then fell asleep right in front of the fucking TV, and never woke up until the national anthem. He had spilled a drink on the rug, and Mary had had a bird over that, too. The Grand, though, that had really been something. Now they had these new-breed movie theaters out in the suburbs, crackerjack little buildings in the middle of 4 miles of parking lot. Cinema I. Cinema I. Cinema I. Screening room. Cinema MCMXLVII. He had taken Mary to one out in Waterford to see The Godfather, and the tickets were $2.50 a crack. And inside it looked like a fucking bowling alley. No balcony, but the Grand. It had a marble floor in the lobby, and a balcony, and an ancient, lovely, grease-clotted popcorn machine, where a big box cost a dime. The character who tore your ticket, which had cost you 60 cents, wore a red uniform, like a doorman, and he was at least 600. And he always croaked the same thing. Hope you enjoy the show! Inside, the auditorium was huge and dark and filled with the smell of dusty velvet. When you sat down, you didn't crack your knees on the seat in front of you. And there was a huge cut-glass chandelier overhead. You never wanted to sit under it, because if it ever fell on you, they'd have to scrape you up with a putty knife. The Grand was... He looked at his wristwatch guiltily. Almost 40 minutes had gone by. Christ, that was bad news. He had just lost 40 minutes, and he hadn't even been thinking that much. Just about the park and the Grand Theater. Is there something wrong with you, Georgie? There might be, Fred. I guess maybe there might be. He wiped his fingers across his cheek under his eye and saw by the wetness on them that he had been crying. He went downstairs to talk to Peter, who was in charge of deliveries. The laundry was in full swing now, the ironer thumping and hissing as the first of the Howard Johnson sheets were fed into its rollers, the washers grinding and making the floor vibrate, the shirt presses going hiss. As Ethel and Rhonda whipped them through. Peter told him the Universal had gone on number 4's truck, and did he want to look at it before they sent it out to the shop? He said he didn't. He asked Peter if Holiday Inn had gone out yet. Peter said it was being loaded, but the silly ass who ran the place had already called twice about his towels. He nodded and went back upstairs to look for Vinnie Mason, but Phyllis said Vinnie and Tom Granger had gone out to that new German restaurant to dicker about tablecloths. Will you have Vinny stop in when he gets back?
I will, Mr. Doss. Mr. Ordner called and wanted to know if you'd call him back.
Thanks, Phyllis. He went back into the office, got the new things that he collected in the inbox, and began to shuffle through them. A salesman wanted to call about a new industrial bleach, Yellow Go. Where do they come up with the names, he wondered, and put it aside for Ron Stone. Ron loved to inflict Dave with new products, especially if he could wangle a free 500 pounds of the product for test runs. A letter of thanks from the United Fund, he put it aside to tack on the announcement board downstairs by the punch clock. A circular for office furniture in executive pine, into the wastebasket. A circular for a phone mate that would broadcast the message and record incoming calls when you were out up to 30 seconds. I'm not here, stupid. Buzz off. Into the wastebasket. A letter from a lady who had sent the laundry 6 of her husband's shirts and had gotten them back with the collars burned. He put it aside for later action with a sigh. Ethel had been drinking her lunch again. A water test package from the university. He put it aside to go over with Ron and Tom Granger after lunch. A circular from some insurance company with Art Linkletter telling you how you could get $80,000 and all you had to do for it was die. Into the wastebasket. A letter from the smart Mick realtor who was peddling the Waterford plant, saying there was a shoe company that was very interested in it, the Tom McCann Shoe Company, no less, no small cheese, and reminding him that the Blue Ribbon's 90-day option to buy ran out on November 26. Beware, puny laundry executive, the hour draweth nigh. Into the wastebasket. Another salesman for Ron, this one peddling a cleaner with the larcenous name of Swipe, he put it with Yellow Go. He was turning to the window again when the intercom buzzed. Vinny was back from the German restaurant. Send him in. Vinny came right in. He was a tall young man of 25 with an olive complexion. His dark hair was combed into its usual elaborately careless tumble. He was wearing a dark red sport coat and dark brown pants. A bow tie. Very rakish, don't you think, Fred? I do, George. I do. How are you, Bart? Vinny asked. Fine, he said. What's the story on that German restaurant? Vinny laughed. You should have been there. That old crowd just about fell on his knees. He was so happy to see us. We're really going to murder Universal when we get settled into the new plant, Bart. They hadn't even sent a circular, let alone their rep. That crowd. I think he thought he was going to get stuck washing those tablecloths out in the kitchen. But he's got a place there you wouldn't believe. Real beer hall stuff. He's going to murder the competition. The aroma? God! He flapped his hands to indicate the aroma and took a box of cigarettes from the inside pocket of his sport coat. I'm going to take share in there when he gets rolling. 10% discount. In a weird kind of overlay, he heard Harry the gun shop proprietor saying, "We give a 10% discount on orders over 300. My God, he thought. Did I buy those guns yesterday? Did I really? That room in his mind went dark. Hey, Georgie, what are you... What's the size of the order? He asked. His voice was a little thick, and he cleared his throat. 400 to 600 tablecloths a week once he gets rolling, plus napkins, all genuine linen. He wants them done in ivory snow. I said that was no problem. He was taking a cigarette out of the box now, doing it slowly so he could read the label. There was something he could really come to dislike about Vinnie Mason. His dipshit cigarettes. The label on the box said, "Players, Navy Cut. Cigarettes. Medium." Now who in God's world except Vinnie would smoke Players, Navy Cut? Or King Sano? Or English Ovals, or Marvels, or Murads, or Twists. If someone put out a brand called Shit on a Stick or Black Lung, Vinny would smoke them. I did tell him we might have to give him a 2-day service until we get switched over, Vinny said, giving him a last loving flash of the box as he put it away. When we go out to Waterford. That's what I wanted to talk to you about, he said. Shall I blast him, Fred? Sure. Blow him out of the water, George. Really? He snapped a light to his cigarette with a slim gold Zippo and raised his eyebrows through the smoke like a British character actor. I had a note from Steve Ordner yesterday. He wants me to drop over Friday evening for a little talk about the Waterford plant. Oh? This morning I had a phone call from Steve Ordner. while I was down talking to Peter Wasserman. Mr. Ordner wants me to call him back. That sounds like he's awfully anxious to know something, doesn't it?
I guess it does,
Vinny said, flashing his number 2 smile. Track wet. Proceed with caution.